to start the meeting for Health and Social Services Monday the 15th, today at 1:31. And we have three members present, and we have the fourth one joining us. Senator Dyson will be here. I'm sure Senator Thomas will come later. We have three bills to come before us today, and we're going to try to complete all three of the bills for this hearing. We have Senate Bill 307, Shelters for Runaway Minors, and we have a SCR 13, Supporting Senior Caregivers. And then in that order, we'll then go to 250, which is insurance coverage for autism spectrum. And this will be the first time for one of my staff members to present a bill. Celeste Hodge will come forward and introduce the bill, and Senator Dyson is now with us, as I said he would be. We have four members present. Ms. Hodge, would you state your name for the record and who you represent and present your bill?
Sure. Good afternoon. My name is Celeste Hodge, staff to Senator Betty Davis. The bill before you, SB 307, essentially would allow emergency residential shelters like Covenant House Alaska to continue competing for federal grant funding. Covenant House Alaska has five programs that include emergency shelter, health care, job and educational assistance, and transitional living. They've served nearly 3,000 Alaskan youth in fiscal year 2009 and have been in Alaska for over 20 years, serving literally tens of thousands of youth. In 2007, Covenant House Alaska was awarded the Federal Basic Center Grant through the Administration for Children and Families. This competitive federal grant supplied Covenant House Alaska with $300,000 phased over 3 years to operate the crisis center at $100,000 per year. The Administration for Children and Families recently notified Covenant House Alaska the crisis center is technically out of compliance with federal grant requirements stated in the Homeless and Runaway Youth Act. Established through the Act, Federal Regulation 45 CFR 1351 18D states the basic center grant may be awarded to facilities with a shelter capacity of 20 beds. Covenant House Alaska holds 40 beds. However, the Act at 42 U.S.C. Section 5712B 2A states the shelter can have a maximum capacity of not more than 20 youth, except where the applicant assures that the state where the center or locally controlled facility is located has a state or local law or regulation that requires a higher maximum to comply with license requirements for child and youth serving facilities. The Administration for Children and Families concedes that states with statutes requiring them to operate a facility over 20 beds will meet the federal requirements. Supporting Senate Bill 307 would allow a statutory change which would make it possible for emergency residential shelters like Covenant House Alaska to continue competing for federal grants by operating under the terms of their license. According to the Department of Health and Social Services, this bill does not create an increased workload for existing staff and carries a zero fiscal note. Madam Chair, that's my introduction of the bill. We do have Lauren with Covenant House here, as well as online, their attorney, Kimberly, who can address questions, technical questions.
All right, thank you very much, Ms. Hodge. We do have some people sign up to testify for this bill. I want to first recognize that Senator Thomas has joined us. And Senator Thomas, as you can see, we are on Senate Bill 307.
307, you bet.
Yes.
I could tell from the testimony.
Yes. Would there be any questions? Yes, Senator Dyson.
Respectfully, Madam Chair, it seems to me that this is very common sense sort of thing. I can't imagine if there's any opposition. And all we're doing here is modifying slightly our state law to let these people continue to do what they've been doing very well. And I have a lot of personal experience with them. So you might consider asking if there's any negative testimony about this. And I don't expect there is a lot, then we might not have to hear all of the testimony that I thought was quite well explained in the package that you put together for us.
Well, thank you. I'll give credit to his hearts there.
I'll get better.
All right, thank you very much. Thanks for those comments, and I will ask if there is going to be anyone opposing this bill before we take testimony. I think the people that are signed up are more or less signed up to answer questions. If there's a statement to be made, we will accept that. If there's no other comments from the committee at this time, we'll open it up for public testimony. And as you can see, this is a committee bill by request so that we may help Covenant House continue with their federal grants. There's one person that signed up, and I think they're just to answer questions. Kimberly, are you there? Kobo?
Madam Chairman, yes, I am present, and I'm just here to answer questions if the committee should have them.
Is there anyone off net there that's opposing this particular piece of legislation?
Not in Anchorage.
Anyone here in the building here in the Senate room? Was there anyone here wishing to testify on this bill here, other than answering questions? Did I see a hand? Yes, could you come, please?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, my name is Wilda Laughlin. I'm legislative liaison for the Department of Health and Social Services. Want to thank the committee for bringing this legislation forward, and also want to thank Covenant House for working very closely with us on this legislation. As Celeste has already testified, it will allow them to operate a 40-bed facility. Just want to be on record that the administration has no concerns and thinks this bill is moving in the right direction.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Yes? Sirian, would you come forward and state your name for the record, please?
For the record, my name is Lauren Rice, and I'm with Covenant House. And I just wanted to say for the record, I appreciate you introducing the committee, bringing forward this legislation. I was going to have some talking points and share a little bit about our work, but I know that there's a couple more bills that you want to hear today, so I'll make this brief. Covenant House just appreciates all the support and wants to note that we brought this to Chair Davis's attention relatively late in the session, and I appreciate it being brought to the committee so quickly.
Thank you very much for your testimony. If there's no one else here to testify, I'd like to close public testimony at this time. We're back now with the bill before us. What is the pleasure of the committee for 307?
Madam Chair, I would advance the motion that Senate Bill 307 pass from this committee to the next committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Hear no objection, so move, then we will take just a brief time to sign the form and we'll go to the next bill. While we're signing the document with the people that's going to present Senate Bill CSR 13, come forward, please. Thank you. Okay, we're back on record. We'll go with the resolution, and we have present staff from Senator Bunda's office. Would you state your name for the record? And
yes, ma'am.
Give your testimony here, I mean, your statement.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Trevor Fulton. I'm staff for Senator Con Bundy, who would be here himself were he able to get a flight out of Anchorage earlier than tomorrow. So he does send his regards, and he does appreciate you hearing his resolution in his absence. SCR 13 is in support of senior caregivers. Alaska has one of the fastest growing senior populations in the nation. Between 1998 and 2008, the number of Alaskan seniors grew by over 50%. That's more than four times the national average. Looking ahead, we see a similar picture. The number of Alaskans 65 years age old or older is expected to grow by 155% in the next 20 years. And the population of those 85 years or older is projected to double by 2050. Along with that growing population will come an increased need for senior caregiving. While advances in medicine, technology, and assisted living practices are enabling seniors to live longer, more productive, and more comfortable lives than ever before, the fact remains that many of our aging loved ones will at some point require some form of caregiving. In fact, more than 25% of all seniors need some level of assistance with their daily activities. So who is it that's providing that assistance? Who are Alaska senior caregivers? While researching this resolution, I came across a quote by Rosalind Carter that sums it up quite nicely. She said, there are only four kinds of people in the world. Those who have been caregivers, those who are currently caregivers, those who will be caregivers, and those who will need caregivers. So Alaskan caregivers are the estimated nearly 97,000 family, friends, partners, and neighbors that provide care to seniors. They are also the nearly 1,600 trained professionals employed in the private duty home care field in Alaska. The sponsor firmly believes that the longer a senior is able to provide for his or her care with the assistance of friends, family, and loved ones, as well as low-cost professional caregivers, the less public payment systems in state and federal governments are burdened. By supporting both family and professional senior caregivers, by encouraging the Department of Health and Social Services to provide additional education on the effects of aging and the importance of caregiving, and by shining a light on the changing demographics of aging in Alaska, SCR 13 reminds the state that it is critical we are prepared to meet and manage the needs of our aging population. The sponsor encourages your support of SCR 13, and I'm here and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have about the resolution.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions of the sponsor? Yes, Senator Dyson.
Yeah. Do we need to adapt the P version?
thank you very much. I was going to bring that up. This is the first time this bill has come before us, and it came to us with the CS. Do I have to say adopted, even though it's brand new, never been introduced before, the original bill? I'm going to ask that of Senator Ellis.
It would be wise to have entertain a motion to adopt a committee substitute.
Okay. Even though it was done by the sponsor, I would entertain a motion for that.
Madam Chair, I would move that we bring the committee substitute for Senate concurrent resolution number 13, identified as /P version, before this committee for discussion.
No objection to that. That is in front of us at this time. Are there any questions of the sponsor? Is there anyone signed up to speak to this resolution? I think there's our Larner Mills, CareNet Inc. Are you there, OffNet?
Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we do.
I'm Lorna Mills. I'm a registered nurse and a small business owner in Anchorage. I own CareNet Inc. and we're a private duty home care provider serving the Anchorage area since 1996. And I have caregivers, mostly homemaker aides, who care for the elderly in their homes, and I'm proud to be able to offer seniors the care they need and deserve, and most importantly, to remain in their own homes. I just want to make a point about many seniors need to be able to make the right selecting a home care provider. And isolated, unmonitored, and unsupervised settings increase the possibility for abuse and financial exploitation,
when work is being done on behalf of a physically or mentally frail individual. And a big difference exists between responsible private duty agencies and care provided by someone through an ad in the classifieds or through a registry. I just want to say that as a member of the National Private Duty and of the Alaska chapter of the National Private Duty Association, I can speak for our group in saying we are dedicated and have made it our mission to preserve the integrity of the private duty home care industry, and that we advocate and practice certain standards. And we have made it one of our goals to educate the community about the National Private Duty Association, promoting the message of the National Private Duty Association in using an NPDA agency. And it's important to have the collaboration effort of the committed companies to keep the reputation of this industry high ethical standards, and also to legislatively in this industry. I do have a couple questions for, I think it was Trevor. Sorry. What do you hope to accomplish by supporting SCR 13? And what are you going to do to support businesses like mine? And what can I do to help you meet these goals? Thank you for allowing me to speak.
Lerner, thank you for your testimony. I don't think it would be necessary that he would have to give you. Trevor is a staffer carrying the bill for Senator Zabande. He has expressed why the bill has been introduced. If there's something that you want to talk personally about, some of the concerns that you might have or some help that you might need, you may contact me as a chair of the committee, or you may talk to Senator Bundy's office about that. But I don't think he should have to answer that question at this point.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you very much. Is there a K Branch there?
Yes, thank you.
Would you like to testify?
Yes, please. My name is Kay Branch. I'm here today to provide public comment on behalf of the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. And as you know, ANTHC is part of the Alaska Tribal Health System and co-manages the Alaska Native Medical Center. I'm the Elder Health Program Coordinator for ANTHC and also staff a statewide committee to address the long-term care needs of Alaska Native elders and persons with disabilities. ANTHC supports Senate Concurrent Resolution Number 13 on behalf of our tribal health partners, older Alaska Native adults, and caregivers. In the resolution, it indicates how many Alaskans are over the age of 65. Now we have 16,000 of those are actually Alaska Native people. And that number is expected to increase by 50% by 2030. Our 85-plus population is also growing quite rapidly, and Alzheimer's disease and related disorders are also affecting the Alaska Native population. We encourage the department to ensure that caregiving resources and education are provided in a way that embraces the unique cultural and linguistic traditions of Alaska Native people. As part of the Medicaid Reform Initiative, SB 61 in fiscal years 08 and 09, the Alaska Tribal Health Organizations worked collaboratively to design a tribal long-term care service development plan that would increase access to both home and community-based and facility services for Alaska Native elders and people with disabilities. This includes components like Senate Concurrent Resolution Number 13 that encourages and support family caregivers to provide care, only supplementing that with formal services when necessary. Service delivery in this manner maintains the family structure and honors the longstanding tradition of caring for elders. The tribal health system partners continue to work with the department to increase home and community-based services at all levels. For example, Division of Senior and Disability Staff will be traveling to rural regions beginning late this month to better understand the challenges of rural service delivery and tribal health organizations. It is through this kind of collaboration that we can ensure equal access to services across the state. In addition to culturally relevant caregiving resources and in-home support, culturally appropriate nursing and assisted living homes are needed to provide the full range of long-term care services to Alaska Native elders and people with disabilities. Therefore, we also seek support for the tribal facility capital projects in Anchorage, Kotzebue, and Bethel. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify.
And thank you very much for your testimony. Any questions? Here, no question. We'll come back to Juno here, and I'd call up Joanne Gibbons.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Joanne Gibbons, and I'm the Deputy Director for the Division of Senior and Disability Services. And on behalf of the administration, I would like to let the committee know that the administration supports this resolution. And I'd also like to thank Senator Bundy for bringing this resolution forward that supports and recognizes the issues with caregivers and seniors in our state and that we anticipate in the future.
And, thank you very much. Any questions?
Any questions?
Senator Dyson.
Yeah, please. My question is very respectful. Kind of back to the question the lady asked. I mean, it would seem to me the implication of this resolution is that we, the legislature, don't think you guys are doing what you ought to be doing, and it's to give you a kick to the fanny and get you going. And it appears to me you do not see it that way. So help me understand, maybe Trevor, you as well, why do you and the senator think we need to call attention to the problem and getting the department to do what they apparently agree they ought to be doing? And so anyway, both of you, help me understand, what does this really accomplish, and why does the department support it?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, the department supports this resolution because the department recognizes the need and is committed to doing what it can with existing resources and future resources in providing the services that we need for caregivers. Currently, we have, through a combination of federal and state dollars and GF dollars, we provide caregiver support, funding for 8 agencies across the state to provide caregiver support services in different communities. Is that enough to meet the statewide need? No, probably not. But we are, you know, committed to doing what we can, both now and in the future, working with the Alaska Commission on Aging as part of their 5-year plan to continue to identify strategies and ways we can improve, you know, service delivery throughout the state.
So if I make
you may continue, yes.
In the resolve thing, what does it mean when it says, what's the implication of us saying that we recognize senior caregivers as a profession? What's the real world impact of that?
Do you want to answer that?
Are you asking that of the director there?
Yeah.
Of me?
Yes.
Sorry. through the chair, Senator Dyson, I think that recognizing something as a profession means recognizing something as a calling and a life's task and work. And in that regard, senior caregiving, whether it's provided by a family member or whether it's provided, in some cases, it's provided by agency staff that work for senior agencies. This particular resolution addresses family caregiver supports. And through some programs, family members sometimes can get paid for providing services. And in that respect, also, it's a profession for them.
So if I may then, so you're not anticipating that this is going to be a precursor for formal training and or licensing?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, we do provide information and assistance and caregiver training through our existing programs. So that opportunity for family caregivers is there. We provide, in addition, counseling and support groups to family members, respite services for family members. It's kind of like one of the issues we try to address is it's very stressful to be a caregiver sometimes in those kinds of things.
So I think the proper answer to my question is no. You do not anticipate a formal training and licensing as an additional requirement for a senior caregiver.
Through the chair, that is correct. No, we don't anticipate licensing.
And this is probably for you, Trevor. Are you and the good senator thinking that this resolution, should it pass, commits us to, as paragraph 2 says, line 16, page 2, to providing all the funding that might be required to do all the things that are outlined here?
Senator Dyson, I know that you asked Trevor to answer that question, but as the chair, I'm going to intercede here and say that he does not have to answer that question, but if you really want an answer for that, you need to speak with Senator Bundy concerning that. But let's take the resolution for what I see it is and what I think all of you should see it as. I think this department should be supportive of it, and any other agencies or anyone dealing with our seniors throughout this whole state of Alaska, because it's a growing population, and it is true that if you're not a caregiver, or you might have to pay off someone care for you, or you know somebody that has to be provided that service, and we provide a great service. This is just bringing to the attention that, yeah, we have this population is growing. We need to do more. I don't think it tells us that we have to put more money in it at any given time, but be aware. We want you to know it's out there and that it's important, not saying that you have to have a license to be a caregiver.
No, and I didn't anticipate that these folks were moving towards license, but that's just the classic thing that both you and I think of as a profession, including yours, you know, and most of these guys sitting here. But I could imagine a situation where all the services that might be required for seniors, you know, that we might agree on, would come back to us in a supplemental budget, and when somebody could questioned it, the supplemental say, hey, you guys passed the resolution that said we supported all this stuff, you know, and it'd be a pretty logical argument. I'm not going to push it.
All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Marie Darling, would you come forward, please?
I'm Marie Darlin, and I represent the AARP Capital City Task Force, and you have a letter of support from us on this. And I won't bother going through a lot of the statistics and all, which you already have and are included actually in the resolution itself. We just want to say that we support this with the idea that, knowing that there are a lot of growing needs, let's say, for caregivers, and are aware that this is going to be a problem that we all face, and therefore we really want to have anybody who has, let's say, any responsibility in this at all to emphasize the need for educating people about what these needs are going to be, whether it's going to be the fact that they are going to be a caregiver or they are going to need a caregiver. But I do think that with the growing senior population, we know that this is going to be something that the department is going to have to really concentrate on in many ways, and we just know that they will be doing it through all their different programs and all. And so we just want to be sure that people realize that this is coming and that the department then itself can do whatever it can to start educating the public, let's say, some maybe who are not aware of any of this or even of what the services that might be available to them when all of a sudden they have need for them. And many times they have no idea where to go. And I think that there could be a little more emphasis given, and this would help do it, on what are the services that are available either through the state or just through community organizations. So we do fully support this.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? No questions. We'll go now to Denise Darnello.
Good afternoon. My name is Denise Darnello, Executive Director for the Alaska Commission on Aging, and we really want to thank you for hearing this legislation and for the opportunity to provide testimony. It's true that the senior population is growing, and it's been growing for the last 10 years. We have currently, our rate is currently the fastest rate of senior growth in the nation. And this is not because we're the new Florida. We don't have new seniors who are moving to our state necessarily, but it's the result of the aging of people who moved here back in the 1970s and the 1980s. Some of us here in this room, members of the baby boom population, who came here to work on jobs with the state's growing economy. And it's these individuals, Alaskans, who have lived here a long time, who are now aging and choosing to remain in Alaska instead of moving down south to Florida or Arizona. And this is a really important population of seniors, a really important population in terms of in thinking about their investment in Alaska. According to a report that was done a couple of years ago by the University of Alaska Institute of Social and Economic Research and with the Alaska Commission on Aging and Department of Health and Social Services, their seniors contribute more than $1.5 billion to the state's economy from their retirement, their Social Security, their health care benefits and savings. And that doesn't even include the seniors who continue to work and also continue to volunteer. In the state, in many community agencies, as well as in taking care of their grandchildren, taking care of people with developmental disabilities, as well as caring for other seniors. We feel this is important legislation because it calls attention to the changing demographics here in Alaska. Our population is aging. We're becoming a little bit more grayer, but a little bit more mature and wiser, hopefully. And that we do need to take a hard look at the types of services that we're providing to make sure that they're sufficient to continue to provide for this population so that they can remain here. So we really thank Senator Bundy's office for introducing this resolution, and we appreciate your hearing of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? No questions? I'll go back off that and Kevin Turkington.
Hi, it's Kevin Turkington.
Okay. Well, you want to testify?
Thank you, and thank you for allowing me to do so. Again, my name is Kevin Turkington. I am the CEO of Senior Care of Alaska in Anchorage, serving Alaskans since 2002, the board president of the Older Persons Action Group since 2003, and the newly formed Alaska chapter of the National Private Duty Association, otherwise known as the MPDA. Alaska chapter of the MPDA is the result of four private competing companies working together for those we feel a strong passion to serve and protect. I'm testifying in support of SCR 13. I believe it can be the vehicle that brings a better balance to our state's legislation and support for the entire senior population. So much of our resources appear to be focused on our low-income seniors, and I agree that these individuals need that support. However, about 75% of the senior population are not eligible for most of these services. The most profound statement of SCR 13 is on line 11 and 12, which states, whereas the longer seniors are able to provide for themselves, the less the public payment systems supported by state and federal governments are burdened. I believe we as a state focus more on providing for low-income persons to the tune of about $38,500 per person of the total of 3,676 recipients in the Medicaid waiver program alone. These costs continue to rise as we increasingly throw more money into a system that over time seems to increase and even encourages dependence on it. There are providers who flat out tell seniors and their families that they need to get their loved ones into a spend-down situation as soon as possible so as to use their services under Medicaid. That's just unacceptable. The recent federal audit and moratorium on a Medicaid program in Alaska speaks loud and clear to the problems we as a state face, including the reality the current system seems to pay for poor management and fraud, making serving the Medicaid system very lucrative for many. Ever wonder why about 90% of agencies serving senior and disabled Alaskans are Medicaid providers? Guaranteed income. Add to that, it appears the state even is considering rewarding these organizations with even more money through a review process if they find they aren't making enough profit providing services under Medicaid. I believe that the best way to serve seniors and lower the cost of doing so is by empowering both the senior and their providers, whether by a family member or a professional caregiver. I believe that this can be accomplished best by filtering all current regulations and subsequent legislation through SCR 13 and the powerful statement it makes on behalf of seniors and their families. I believe it says that we as a state really do care about our seniors, all of them. I think that
assistance, press 0. Breakout session, press 1. Dial out, press 3. Admittance options, press 4. Mute, press 5. For meeting notes options, press 6. For Q&A options, press 7. For advanced features, press 8. To exit the meeting and return to the main menu, press 9. To rejoin the meeting, press star.
Are we still on?
Assistance, press 0. Breakout session, press 1. Dial out, press 3. Admittance options, press 4. Mute, press 5.
on record here, off net and here in the room. So we'll continue with the resolution. Is there anyone else to testify? Hear no one else. We will close public testimony on the resolution. Resolution number 13. Any comments that need to be made by the committee? I'd just like to say that I would like you to pass along to Senator Bondi that we appreciate him bringing the resolution forward. And it is my intent to ask for it to be moved out of committee at this time.
Madam Chair, I would move that the committee substitute for Senate concurrent resolution number 13, version /P, be moved from this committee with individual recommendations. And I believe there's no fiscal votes.
No.
Anyway, that we move it with individual recommendations.
All right. It's so moved, and no objection. It's done, and we will sign the statement and move on to the next bill that we have. Autism coming up. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I just want to thank you for
getting that back on record. Yeah.
Okay. Oh, okay.
We're going to take up Senate Bill 250, Insurance Coverage for Autism Spectrum. And we are proud to have with us today Representative Peterson. Representative Peterson has introduced this and that other body over there. The same bill, I'm hearing this bill so that we could at least get it through this committee in case his bill is going to be able to come over to us. We won't have to spend time going over it at the last minute. This is an important piece of legislation. It's important to Senator Representative Peterson, and I thought he might want to present his bill to us. I have a statement. It's pretty much similar to your statement, and I'm doing it at your request, so if you would like to present, it's quite okay. If not, I'll have my staff to do it.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just put myself on the record. I'm Representative Pete Peterson. I represent District 19. That's Northeast Anchorage, the Muldoon area. And I appreciate the committee hearing this bill today. My staff, Mercedes, actually had planned to come up here and help the aide from your office with this bill. And so if you don't mind, I would just like to encourage you to ask questions of the experts that are online, because they have more experience in the field of autism than I do, or you know, or the staff members.
All right, thank you very much. Before we get started, I do want to say that it was my intention to have the bill introduced today and listen to the experts if they are online, and the bill will have to come back to us at a later time. It was not my intent to move this bill out of the committee today. There are several people that signed up, but we'll first have an overview by Senator Overmyer. Mr. Overmyer.
Okay. For the record, I'm Tom Obermeyer, aide to Senator Davis. The bill before you is a committee substitute for Senate Bill 250. It's 26LS1400/R, as in Romeo. This is an act requiring insurance coverage for autism spectrum disorders, describing the method for establishing a treatment plan for those disorders and defining the treatment for those disorders and providing for an effective date. This bill mandates coverage for diagnosis and treatment of autism spectrum disorders in any plan offered by the healthcare insurer. That's a synopsis of the fiscal note. In Senate Bill 250 requires that healthcare insurers in Alaska provide coverage for the autism spectrum disorders, including behavioral health therapies that after 30 years of study have shown to be the only effective treatment of these disorders. Treatment has been shown to improve the symptoms of ASD, that's autism spectrum disorders, and in some cases even eliminate the need for special education services for a child with ASD. The incremental societal cost of not treating an individual with autism has been estimated by Harvard economist Michael Gantz to be approximately $3.2 million. The cost savings alone in special education to age 22 for each autistic child has been estimated at $187,000 to $203,000, or $1.1 million to age 55 relative to the 3 years of early intensive behavior treatment. It's been found that very early treatment and recognition of this disorders is the proper way to deal with the problem, and it saves a great deal of money. Senate Bill 250 only mandates coverage for autism spectrum disorders for about the 40% of Alaskans who are covered by insurers or insurance company plans. Self-funded health plans, often sponsored by the largest employers, including the state health plan or Alaska Care Plan, usually are exempt from the state regulation because they are preempted by federal ERISA law. The state historically, however, has complied with state insurance laws, including mandated benefit laws, even if it's not required to do so. The Division of Insurance to date has not enforced insurance laws on state union health trusts, and its ability to do so is subject to legal debate. I don't know, but it's possible that, and I requested that Linda Hall be online if there were any questions about the insurance. The prevalence of ASD. The Centers for Disease Control reports that about 1 in 110 children are affected with ASDs and is much more prevalent among boys, about 1 in 58. This dramatic increase from just a decade ago. It's unclear how much of this increase is due to a broader definition of ASDs with better diagnoses or a combination of both. Despite being treatable, many children diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder never receive the treatment they need. Families can go bankrupt or mortgage their future, trying to provide for their children with treatment to ameliorate their conditions. Families are forced to dig into their savings, retirement funds, and their other children's college savings because ASD is not covered by insurance plans. Although some insurers may already cover some types of autism, most insurance plans explicitly exclude the treatment of ASD, even when the service would otherwise be covered by the health plan as a regular medical condition. I included in the sponsor statement what autism spectrum disorders are. The National Institute of Mental Health reports that ASD, also known as pervasive development disorders, cause severe and pervasive impairment in thinking, feeling, language, and the ability to relate to others. These disorders are usually diagnosed early in childhood, usually before the age of 3, and range from a severe form called autistic disorder through pervasive development disorder not otherwise specified to a much milder form, Asperger's syndrome. They also include rare disorders, Rett syndrome and childhood disintegrative disorder. All of these can be debilitating to families emotionally, physically, and financially. Societal rewards of early detection and proper treatment include stronger families, healthier children, and savings in health transfer costs later in life. I noted that President Obama has stated the coverage of treatment and other types of funding for ASD would be a priority of his administration. The Senators Durbin, Casey, and Mendez Menendez introduced the Autism Treatment Acceleration Act of 2009, mandating the insurance coverage of ASD. Implementing Senate Bill 250, while a federal mandate is pending, would allow insurers and the state needed time to adjust to the requirements of such a law. It would also bring healthcare professionals and jobs to the state. Since March 2009, 11 states have passed legislation regarding mandatory insurance coverage of treatment for ASD, with 8 states having enacted legislation prior to March of 2009. The District of Columbia, Puerto Rico, and 19 additional states currently have similar legislation pending. These enacted and pending bills, including the Autism Treatment Acceleration Act, demonstrate nationwide need for relief for families of autistic individuals. Autism is not a state or region-specific condition. Families burdened with the costs of autism are unlikely to relocate to one of those 11 states that require insurance companies to cover the cost of ASD treatment. On the other hand, families of any state should not be burdened alone with the great cost of treating a disorder they could not prevent or predict. Moreover, they should not find themselves the victim of unwarranted discrimination by health insurance companies. Although there is no cure for ASD, Senate Bill 250 will help significantly to treat hundreds of Alaskans suffering from these disorders.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone online that's to speak to this bill other than those that's testifying for or against the bill? Any professionals, anyone that we've asked to be online? Anyone in the room? We do have our insurance director here. I don't think she signed up to speak.
Madam Chairman, I just signed up if there are questions.
You'll sign up for questions only?
Correct.
And we do have your chart that you pass out, so we're pretty much well aware of that. What we're going to do first is adopt the CS that's in front of you. And I'd ask for a motion from the Vice Chair.
Madam Chair, I would move that we bring the committee substitute for Senate Bill 250/R version before the Senate Health and Social Services Committee for purposes of discussion.
Thank you very much. At this time, we're going to open it up for public testimony. And this is in Anchorage. We got quite a few people. Is that Laurie? Is there a Laurie there? Anchorage? You in? Laurie, are you there?
Senator Davis, this is Kathy Fitzgerald in Anchorage, and Laurie is not here. There is a Laurie King that's from Juneau, perhaps.
I am here. Laurie Unum is here as well.
That's the person. Would you like to testify?
Yes, ma'am. My name is Laurie Unum, and I'm an attorney with Autism Speaks, which is a national autism science and research and advocacy organization. I'm also the parent of an 8-year-old son with autism, and I'm a former law professor, but I gave up my legal career to advocate full-time on behalf of kids with autism when I saw the inequity in the insurance arena. So I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to speak today on Senate Bill 250. And I believe you might have some slides. I have a PowerPoint. Do y'all have those slides in front of you?
It's in the package. Thank you.
Okay, very good. And again, I'm senior policy advisor and counsel for Autism Speaks now, and I do work nationwide on autism insurance reform. I heard the introductory comments from the staffer, which I thought summed up the situation very well, so I'm not going to repeat what has already been said, but I thought you would be interested to know the experience in some of the other states that have already passed autism insurance reform. And specifically, if you look in my slideshow, there's a very colorful map called States with Autism Insurance Reform. You all have that? It's about the sixth slide if you have all of the slides.
You can go on.
Okay. And it goes through the list of states that have passed meaningful reform. And by meaningful, I would say I think my numbers will vary slightly from what you heard in the introductory remarks. At Autism Speaks, we consider 15 states to have enacted meaningful autism insurance reform, meaning that kids can actually get the kind of therapy that is prescribed for them and at least something close to the amount that is prescribed for them. I can tell you from a personal perspective, my son, you heard about the differing degrees of severity of autism spectrum disorder. My son has the most severe kind, autistic disorder, and his therapy has cost us out of pocket $75,000 per year. We have been audited on our taxes 3 times because of that extraordinary medical expense, and I'm happy to say that we have passed our audits. You know, most kids don't require that much therapy, but the few truly severe kids do. And, you know, I wonder how many families in Alaska do you know of that could make that kind of financial sacrifice, even if they were willing to do so? I know they would be willing. When you see the difference that behavior therapy makes for your child, you would do whatever you can. But not every family has that kind of money to sacrifice. And that's why I hope we can require insurance to cover this disorder and to cover the most commonly prescribed treatment for the disorder, which is the applied behavior analysis therapy. Now, you can see on the map in front of you that Indiana and Minnesota passed reform in 2001, and I have an asterisk beside Minnesota because that state, it wasn't through legislation in Minnesota. It came about through litigation. The Attorney General of Minnesota sued Blue Cross Blue Shield for failure to cover autism, and as a part of the settlement order, Minnesota has been covering it fully since 2001. So there is data out there that is almost 10 years old from both Indiana and Minnesota showing what this has cost. In 2007, South Carolina and Texas enacted reform, and then you can see all of the states in 2008 and 2009. And as your staffer mentioned, it is pending in 19 states right now. Now, the next slide is called Excerpt from 2008 Council of Affordable Health Insurance Mandates in the States. And you can see there that this is a report from the Council for Affordable Health Insurance, which is the insurance industry's own trade organization. Their own trade organization indicates that covering autism has impacted premiums by less than 1%. You can see some of the other mandates, contraceptive, in vitro fertilization, prescriptions, 5 to 10%. So even per their own cost analysis, covering autism is less than 1%. More telling than that, what I was told you might be interested in is some actual cost data from the states that have enacted this legislation. So if you look at the slide called South Carolina State Employee Health Plan, this is data that's pretty hot off the press. As I mentioned, the law passed in South Carolina in 2007, and it became applicable, it went into effect 2008, but it first became applicable to the state employee health plan January 1 of last year. So we have 1 full year of data knowing exactly what the fiscal impact of this benefit is. And just by way of reference, South Carolina has a population of 4.5 million, and there are 350,000 members in the state employee health plan. I'm from South Carolina. You can probably hear my accent. And I was very active in attempting to get the legislation passed here. While we were trying to pass it, our state budget office put out a fiscal impact statement. The first one they put out estimated that it would cost $18.9 million. It would cost the state $18.9 million to cover it for their state employees. That estimate was later revised downward to $9 million, but that was the final estimate. Well, we finally now have the actual claims data, and what it actually cost in 2009 for the entire year was $856,371. So you can see the cost is really quite minimal when spread across the entire pool In fact, that last figure on your slide, which I hope you have in front of you, is that the premium increase per member per month is 20 cents. 20 cents so that all the kids with autism in South Carolina can get the coverage they need. And also, by way of reference, I should divulge that South Carolina does have caps in its autism statute. It provides coverage only through age 16, and the coverage for applied behavior analysis, this ABA therapy, is capped at $50,000 per year. So it's not exactly an apples-to-apples comparison with Alaska's bill, but it's pretty darn close, and you can see that the cost impact is incredibly minimal, especially for the benefit. You heard reference to the Harvard study showing that the lifetime cost for each child with autism who does not get treated is $3.2 million. If you're not motivated by just the human cost and the that it's the right thing to do to provide coverage for these kids, just think about it from a fiscal perspective and think about how much it's going to save the state for these kids to get treatment. And fully 50% of them will become indistinguishable from their peers by first grade and go right into a mainstream first grade classroom, saving the state an awful lot of money. I don't want to take up all of your time, but I would love to answer any questions if you have them. I have worked in many of the states that have passed this legislation and working in many more right now, so I'd be happy to entertain whatever types of questions you have.
All right, thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Senator Passman?
Yes, I was wondering why, if you know, North Carolina chose age 21 and age 16 and $50,000. In the statute before us, we have age 21 and $36,000. And just wondering what the policy issues are behind the age and numbers.
Yes, I do know. And I wrote the legislation originally in South Carolina. When I wrote it, it didn't have any dollar cap or any age cap, just because I thought, philosophically, that was the right way to go. But politically, of course, you have to make compromises. And age 16, I hate to admit this, but it was kind of randomly selected. There's not really any scientific basis for the selection of 16. And $50,000 was a compromise when the insurance industry, well, let me elaborate on this for a second because it's a good question. The insurance industry convinced the legislators that a cap was needed only as to ABA therapy, the behavior therapy, because the insurance industry said it did not know how to make fiscal projections for ABA therapy. It said, we know how to project the cost of speech therapy or doctor's visits or occupational therapy. We do not know how to estimate the fiscal ramifications of covering ABA therapy. So the legislature asked me to write in a dollar cap, and I wrote in $75,000 because my son is severe and that's what it had actually cost us. The bill proceeded at a $75,000 level for a long time, and then shortly before passage, as you all know how these things magically happen sometimes, it got negotiated down to $50,000 at the last minute. So that's the story of the $50,000 cap.
You may continue.
If I might ask, what was the age limit that you first advanced?
I first advanced 16, to be honest. At the time we were doing this in South Carolina, I was completely unsure if it was going to pass at all, to be perfectly honest. And I didn't have any particular basis for it. I was just trying to write something in reasonable enough that I thought the legislature might be willing to enact this reform. But I will also tell you that of the 15 states that now have reform, 16 is on the low end. Most states are between 18 and 22. I've got a comparison chart. I think it's slide number 10 that doesn't show all of the 15, but it shows six of the states. You can see what the dollar caps and what the age caps are. And if the committee would be interested, I could send by email. I do also have a comparison chart that shows all 15 of the states in some detail.
That would be helpful.
Okay.
I see comparison of states, but that would be helpful, what you said. I think, Senator Dyson, did you have your hand?
Yeah.
Thank you, ma'am, both for your efforts and the expertise you bring to this discussion. It seems to me, and I'm trying to think about this in a broad public policy realm, that we as a culture have decided that these almost random disabilities that appear in different families, that we need to share the cost of the remediation because it's too overwhelming for one family. And then, and as your documentation points out, ultimately it is cost effective with the early intervention. And I have more experience with this particular disability than I ever wanted. Why haven't we decided to pay for this out of the tax base like we do other things to promote the general welfare instead of the insurance? And particularly here, it's very selective and very disproportionate sharing of the burden.
That's a great question, actually, and I will tell you that shortly after my son was diagnosed, when I was still teaching law school, I spent a lot of time thinking about that very issue and really trying to wrap my mind around, okay, I know the system is broken, but is it the insurance industry? Should it be a Medicaid issue? Is it the education system? What is the proper fix here? Actually, some states have attempted to do this through government programming instead of through insurance. Throughout the 1990s, Wisconsin, Maryland, Medicaid waiver programs that were specific to autism, and some of them still have them, and South Carolina has one too. What we have found, though, is that none of the states who have tried it that way have been able to pump enough money into their Medicaid waiver program to treat all the kids. So even like in South Carolina, we have a very favorable federal match of almost 70%. But even with the federal matching dollars and the state allocation, we have waiting lists of several hundred children who wait on the list for 2 and 3 years. And when you've got a disability like autism and your doctor says to you, you need to go out and get ABA therapy immediately, you know, it doesn't do much good to wait for 2 or 3 years when that early intervention window is, you know, that's such a critical time for rewiring the brain. So it really is, it's a valid question that you raise, and I think it's just a financial issue that the states haven't been able to pump enough money into it. And at core, you know, it is a medical disability. Your doctor diagnoses you with this, and your doctor prescribes a treatment regime. And so for the people who do have private insurance, it seems only fair that private insurance kick in and play its part.
Yeah, thank you. And your response was a very enlightening one. And I suspected indeed that it was a practical problem rather than a public policy purist perspective. And I suspect that one of the reasons that the states that have gone to the general financing of it have not been able to get the public support, and that their elected leaders who want to tax them more in order to take care of this great public need have felt the pushback from the taxpayers. And I understand that. And thanks for being thoughtful about that.
I appreciate your comment.
Thank you very much. Senator Thomas?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Thanks for your testimony there.
That's to Madam Chair here. But anyhow, I was curious about the numbers. There were some huge numbers indicated in some of the information about the cost of per individual over a period of time. particularly without care. But even with care, the numbers were rather large. And then I look at the example of South Carolina. The estimates range from 9 to almost 19 million, and the actual costs were $856,000.
Yeah.
And I'm curious about the number of kids that would have been involved here with a 350,000 member state health plan. It seems to me that if there were 800 kids at 1,000 a year, that's $800,000, or vice versa. How could that, the obvious costs then are just almost nothing, because I'm sure the number of kids in 350,000 members, families, has to be a pretty healthy number. 50 or 100,000 kids, I would think. You know, I'm just drawing that number out of the air, looking at the number of people and families. If you took that number and divided that into 856, you would come out with pennies almost per child for care. Can you explain to me a little how we get to this 856,000 number?
Yes, I can. And let me give a two-pronged answer. First of all, just a disclaimer to say that I'm under no illusion that the cost will continue to be that low in perpetuity. I think that with any new benefit that's rolled out, there's a ramping up period. So I expect that it will be somewhat higher next year, although I don't think it will ever approximate even the low-end fiscal estimate from the state of $9 million. It may be, I don't know, it may be double what it was this year due to ramping up. But more importantly on your question, if you go back to the second slide, I have, and this will kind of answer the question, I have a chart there called Pervasive Developmental Disorders at the top, and it shows the five distinct diagnoses under there.
I'm sorry, which page was that again?
I should be the second page after my title page.
Second.
It's a blue, if y'all have color, it's a blue and purple chart.
I got it, I think. Go right ahead.
It's very enlightening. It goes right to the heart of your question. So the purple boxes are the three distinct diagnoses that are commonly called autism spectrum disorder. Autistic disorder, Asperger's syndrome, and pervasive developmental disorder not otherwise specified. If you look at the bottom in each of those boxes, you can see autistic disorder accounts for one-third of all autism spectrum disorder. Asperger's counts for less than a sixth. And this very mild category, PDD-NOS, accounts for approximately half of all autism spectrum disorder. It's really only the kids in that first category, autistic disorder, which is also known as, some people just call that autism. Those are your severe kids. And those are the only ones who are being prescribed this intensive behavioral therapy. So you take a massive prevalence number like 1 in 110, and you think, oh, my gosh, this is going to cost a fortune. But you have to recognize that only a third of those even have the severe diagnosis, and only some of those are going to be prescribed a full 40-hour-per-week ABA therapy program. And frankly, even of the ones who are prescribed the intensive program, not all of them are going to take advantage of it because it's incredibly intrusive. You know, this therapy takes place in your home, and I literally have therapists in my home working with my son every day. You know, sadly, not every family is willing to make the lifestyle adjustment necessary, and not to mention that, you know, especially in remote rural areas, there might be provider access problems. So one reason the fiscal note was so far off in South Carolina and in most states is that the budget analysts just take the prevalence number and multiply it times 36,000 or times 50,000 or whatever the cap is and assume that every child will need, will be prescribed, will get, and will pursue the maximum treatment, and it just doesn't work that way. And then one more thing, we actually do know exactly how many kids it was in South Carolina who were getting treatment. There are 62,000 kids within the target age range, which we took to be age 2 through age 16. And we started at 2 just because pretty unusual to get diagnosed before 2 or much before 2. So 62,000 kids between the ages of 2 and 16, and the number of kids that actually were prescribed and took advantage of the therapy in 2009 was 64.
Thank you very much.
For those really severely affected who can get the therapy, it's an incredibly meaningful benefit, but it's not something that will absolutely break the bank like you think it would when you just look at the statistical data.
Further question?
Do you have any examples of the in the other states of what you said you would anticipate that would be a low number to begin with, obviously, especially since only 64 kids of a relatively large population took part? Do you have any statistics that are longer, 5 to 10 years, with any of the other states? And then a second question I had was I'm not sure the reason for the slide that says self-funded ERISA plans. I know what self-funded ERISA plans are, but I wasn't sure why the inclusion of that slide in your presentation.
Okay. All right. I'll go to the first question first. We do have data from Minnesota, and let me just caveat it by saying it's very difficult for us to present much data on the cost because, like, the state employee health plan in South Carolina was very forthcoming with their data, but private insurers are less forthcoming with their data. And so it might be a question more fruitfully directed at the private insurers. But we do have the information from Minnesota. And again, in Minnesota, the benefit is unlimited. So there's no age cap and no dollar cap. And it's been in effect for 9 years. And the only figure, there are two figures that I have from their Blue Cross Blue Shield. And that is one, that the average utilization on an ABA program was $30,000 per year. So notwithstanding the lack of a dollar cap, it was still an average of $30,000 per year. And secondly, the premium increase in Minnesota has been 83 cents per member per month. And, you know, one thing I failed to highlight before I move on to your second question, Autism Speaks did pay an independent actuary to conduct an analysis on the companion bill to 250 on Alaska House Bill 187. And this analyst, this certified actuary, has been projecting cost on these autism bills with a fair amount of accuracy over the last year or so. And he projected, he's a little on the high side, I think, but he projected a cost of $1.34 per month on the Alaska bill as written.
Thank you very much for that information.
You're welcome. And then the last question you asked me was about why did I have the information on the self-funded plans?
Yes.
The reason is because a lot of times when I testify, an opponent will stand up and say, this is not a very effective way to reach the kids with autism because only a small slice of the pie is being covered. And one of the things that I like to point out is that when a state chooses to mandate a benefit, a lot of the self-funded companies, the ERISA-regulated plans, will voluntarily follow suit. So this slide is just a small sampling of companies that have elected to provide an autism benefit. And Microsoft, of course, is one that has been doing it for quite some time. And I believe their administrator is Premera Blue Cross Blue Shield, who I understand is a predominant insurer in Alaska as well.
Thank you.
Senator Passman has a question.
Yes, I noticed that in the slide a couple of states have a different maximum dollar cap based upon age. Is there any rational support for that?
Not especially. Again, those are a result of a political process. there is some thought that, well, surely kids don't need as much therapy once they enter public school. I think that is true to some extent, depending on the severity again. You know, my own son goes to school from 7:30 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. He gets home at 2:45, and at 3 o'clock a therapist arrives and works with him until 7:30 every day. So we do still manage to get in a lot of therapy time because he still is making significant progress and still needs it. But there probably is some trailing off of need at those elementary schools.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. We're going to take one other testimony before we adjourn. It's almost time for us to close out. I want to hear from the Blue Cross Blue Shield person. Are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Would you state your name for the record, please?
Yes, Chair. My name is Sheila Tolman, and I'm with Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska.
Okay, do you wish to testify?
I do.
You may.
Madam Chair, members of the Senate Health and Social Services Committee, thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 250. It's already been pointed out today that this legislation will not impact self-funded plans, which are subject to ERISA and not subject to state mandate laws. What this bill will do, though, is impact the 40% of the market, which represents the most fragile of purchasers, the individuals and small employers in Alaska. Senate Bill 250 imposes a mandate on health insurers such as Blue Cross by requiring that all of our policies include coverage for treatment of autism spectrum disorders, including therapies that are mainly educational and social skills-based and not medical in nature. These are generally considered outside the realm of healthcare. We estimate that the mandate contained in Senate Bill 250 could add as much as 3% to the cost of health insurance premiums. Therefore, we think the committee should know that this is not a cost-free mandate. As the committee members know, in Alaska, the individual and small group insurance markets are already under tremendous cost and price pressures, and we are concerned that Senate Bill 250 will add another cost burden to a relatively small segment of an already price-stressed insurance market. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to try and answer them. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Any questions? Yes, Senator Passman?
Do you dispute the $1.34 per month premium increase?
Through the chair, we believe that there will be a slightly higher per member per month increase. I don't have that figure with me right now, but it's something I can try to locate.
If it were to, if I may, Madam
Chair. You may continue.
If it were to be applied over a larger population base, would that likely bring the premium down?
Through the chair, I think we've already done our estimates on it impacting the insured market that we have, so that already includes our individual and small group and large group.
I don't think
that's going down. Well, we have the chance to talk to her again.
Would you be able to join us again when we bring this bill back up? You said you might be able to provide us some information. If you could prepare that information and get it to us, it would be very helpful.
Yes, I would be happy to do that.
Thank you very much. We are not closing public testimony, but we are going to adjourn at this time. It's 3 o'clock. We have other meetings that we have to attend. And so we will pick up at the next meeting with the rest of the testimony. This information has been very valuable that we have gotten. And so that would give the committee time to look at some of the other material and be ready to deal with this further when we meet again. We'll join at this time, and it's like 3 minutes after 3:00.